Thank you so much, Stu. It's good to be with you this morning. There is only one effective solution to world poverty. It is the only solution that has ever worked or will ever work. This solution is evident from the economic history of every wealthy nation of the world today. And this solution is consistent with the teachings of the Bible about productivity, property, government, and personal moral values. So I want to tell you about that solution to world poverty today. How did I get into this idea? How did I get into this topic? Several years ago, a woman from Nairobi, Kenya, in conversation said to me, "Wayne, why is Africa so poor?" I could see the earnest longing in her eyes. And I was silent, and then she said, "Are we under a curse?" I was stunned, but I had no answer. And after an awkward silence, I had to say to her, "I'm sorry, I don't know." Africa has 13% of the world's population. Yes, 13% of the world's population and 18% of the world's landmass. But it produces 1% of the total economic output of the world each year. Why? And why are countries such as Haiti, Stu, or many other countries in Latin America or in Asia, why do they remain in poverty? As often happens, that very brief encounter in a conversation when someone asked me, "Why is Africa so poor?" and I couldn't answer it, that brief encounter set me on a task of investigation to try to find out the causes of poverty in nations that don't seem to be able to escape from poverty. Soon I began talking with a friend and fellow elder at Scottsdale Bible Church named Barry Asmus. He's a professional economist. He's senior economist with the National Center for Policy Analysis. And he and I, as we began to talk, found that our academic backgrounds provided complementary perspectives to help solve this problem of world poverty. His background in years of lecturing and writing and teaching on macroeconomics, and my background over 30 years of teaching and writing about the ethical and moral teachings of the Bible and biblical theology, we began to find that we shared similar perspectives in investigating the problem of poverty and why it persisted. And we began giving series of seminars, first on 37 factors that lead to wealth or poverty within nations, and then we had a presentation called 50 Factors That Lead to Wealth or Poverty Within Nations. And finally, out of that work over a few years, came this book, The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution, and we have 78 factors that contribute to wealth or poverty. You say 78. How can anyone solve a problem that is so complex? Let me tell you, poverty is a complex problem because it has to do with multiple interactions of human beings and governments throughout the entire nation. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Before I tell you more about what the solution is, I have to introduce two economic concepts. And this is probably elementary for many of you, but I'm not sure. And so the first concept is per capita income. Per capita means per person. And per capita income is basically the standard measure of whether a country is rich or poor. The world map on the cover of this book has a color-coded system whereby countries are colored according to their per capita income. If their per capita income is above $20,000 per person per year, they're green on the map. That's the United States, Canada, Europe, Australia. And then if they're in the middle income range, they're blue on the map. Russia, China, much of Latin America. If they're in a low income range, or what someone might say low middle, but it's basically poor, they're red on the map. India, some parts of South America. And if they're dark red, they're in the very low income, very poor income range, $3,000 per year annual income produced in the economy, and that would be much of Central Africa, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Haiti, and other countries. So per capita income is the measure of whether a country is rich or poor. If I meet you and you're an average person from a foreign country and you tell me you're from Norway or Sweden or Switzerland or the United Kingdom, I expect you're fairly wealthy by world standards. But if I meet you and you're from Zimbabwe or North Korea or Bangladesh, you're poor by world standards. Why is that? We began to work on this problem, and we more and more focused on the fact that the determinants of poverty or wealth in the world are largely found at the level of the nation as a whole. And so this book is not speaking about how to solve poverty with individuals by helping poor individuals or helping poor communities. It's aimed at the level of the nation, and it's asked how can poverty be solved at the level of a nation. We don't know of any book that's ever been written from a Christian perspective with biblical teachings and biblical moral values that addresses poverty at the level of the whole nation. So per capita income, that's the total value of everything produced in the world, the total value of everything produced in a nation in a year divided by the number of people. Per capita income in the United States is about $50,000 per year. But how does that compare to other nations? Ethiopia, $1,200 per capita income. Haiti, $1,300. Uganda, $1,400. Pakistan, $2,900. These are the dark red countries on the map. They're very, very poor. And then low middle income countries, still poor. India, $3,900. Honduras, $4,600. Compared to the U.S., $50,000. And then low middle income countries, China, $9,000 per capita income, Peru, $11,000, Mexico, $15,000, just to give you an idea of where those countries are. They're middle income countries. And then the high income countries, Japan, $36,000 per capita income, the UK, $37,000, Germany, $39,000, the United States, $50,000. Now, per capita income doesn't tell us everything about a country and its people. If you look at this map, you'll see that Saudi Arabia is green. That puts it in the rich category. The problem with Saudi Arabia, it has high per capita income, but we don't learn there from the map about the distribution of income. In Saudi Arabia, the royal family has all the money in its own hands, and most of the population lives in abysmal poverty. But per capita income is still very important because as long as per capita income remains low, the country remains poor. Now, the second economic concept is gross domestic product, or GDP. This is the standard measure of what a whole country produces in a year. Greg Mankiw's economics textbook says the GDP is the market value of all the final goods and services produced within a country in a given period of time. Goods and services. Goods are how many pairs of shoes are made, how many bushels of apples are brought to market and sold, how many bicycles are manufactured, how many shirts are sewn and sold in the marketplace. The total market value of all the goods produced in a nation plus the services. Services would be medical exams given by a doctor, house cleaning services by a house cleaner, auto repair by an auto mechanic, classes taught by a teacher. Whenever someone's paid for a service, that contributes to gross domestic product as well. Now, per capita income is the gross domestic product divided by the number of people in the nation. Now, I'm going to use Honduras as an example, and I'm going to use very round numbers. Honduras has 8 million people, and its gross domestic product, GDP, is $36 billion. 8 million people divided into $36 billion, you get a per capita income of $4,500 per year. Honduras is poor. Imagine what would happen, however, if Honduras could change its gross domestic product from $36 billion to $72 billion, double its economic production. $72 billion, divide 8 million people into that, all of a sudden, Honduras would have $9,000 per capita income. It'd be up in the middle income range. It would move from poverty to increased prosperity. So the goal for every poor nation that wants to emerge from poverty is this: what will increase our gross domestic product? What will increase our GDP? Because that will increase our per capita income, assuming population is relatively stable. And that will move the country from poverty to greater prosperity. Therefore, the focus of efforts to overcome poverty in a nation must have a laser focus on one question: what will increase the production of goods and services in our country? That's the correct goal for every nation that wants to escape from poverty. It's the only goal that will bring a country out of poverty. So the question then for every leader and every person of influence in a poor country is, what can we do to increase our GDP? And we have 78 factors in the book that fall in three areas, and I'm going to talk about them in more detail in a few minutes, but I'll tell you the three areas. One area is the economic system. It needs to adopt a free market economy. The second area is the government and its laws. And there, government must be devoted to serving the needs of the people rather than the selfish needs of the rulers. And third, cultural beliefs and values. And those basically are the moral values consistent with the teachings of the Bible. So economics, government, and cultural and moral values and beliefs. Before I talk about those in detail, however, I want to mention some other goals that have been suggested by people for solving poverty, other goals than increasing production of goods and services. One goal that people have suggested is more foreign aid. This is Jeffrey Sachs in his book, The End of Poverty. But let me tell you, no nation in history has ever escaped from poverty by means of foreign aid. Foreign aid given through the governments of poor countries usually does more harm than good because it entrenches corrupt rulers in power. It fattens their personal bank accounts, and it foments civil wars over control of the big prize, access to the nation's treasury, and all the aid money. Economists such as William Easterly, Paul Collier, Dambisa Moyo, and others have written extensively about the harmful results of foreign aid. Dambisa Moyo, Zimbabwean economist, recently wrote this: aid has been and continues to be an unmitigated political, economic, and humanitarian disaster for most parts of the developing world. Now, Moyo goes on to explain she is not opposed to humanitarian or emergency aid, which helps people affected by catastrophes, earthquake, or something like that. And she is not opposed to charity-based aid distributed by charitable organizations, but she is opposed to aid payments made directly to governments through government-to-government transfers or agencies such as the World Bank. The Bible supports the idea that nations must produce their own prosperity. When Israel came into the Promised Land, in Deuteronomy 8, God promised not that they would have perennial donations of wealth and riches from other nations, but God promised them hills filled with iron and copper, which they would then have to dig and refine, and fields filled with vines and fig trees, which they would have to tend and harvest each year. God's blessing of prosperity on the people of Israel, promised in Deuteronomy 8, would come by productive work. And even the poor in Israel had to work for what they got by gathering the gleanings that were left at the edges of the fields, according to Leviticus 19, 9 to 10. There is no thought in the Bible that poor people or poor nations were to become dependent on donations from others year after year. To repeat, no nation in history has ever escaped poverty by means of foreign aid. The Marshall Plan for Germany after World War II is not an exception to that, because that was a wealthy nation with highly trained workforces, a functioning legal system, factories, roads, railroads, ports. The Marshall Plan simply helped rebuild what was destroyed by World War II. It did not bring a poor nation out of poverty. Now, what about charitable gifts of things like food and medical care? Margaret and I give to organizations that provide those charitable gifts, and we think they're, in most cases, a very good idea. But I think we have to remember that these charitable gifts are food and medical care, say, these charitable gifts are addressing the symptoms, hunger and disease, rather than the cause, and that is the poor nation is not producing enough of its own food and enough of its own medical care. Another solution that some have suggested is debt forgiveness. Make Poverty History was a campaign that campaigned for that recently. Forgiveness of a poor nation's debts is not the answer to poverty either, however, because it is just more foreign aid carried out in a two-step process. First the loan, then cancel the loan. It's not the correct solution. What about more natural resources? If a country could discover and extract more natural resources, wouldn't that solve the problem of poverty? There's some merit to this idea, and there are some instances where it's been helpful, but too often resources become more of a curse than a blessing because they lead to continual wars to control the immense oil money or mineral money in the country, and it's too easy to live off resource wealth rather than learning to produce your own wealth. Natural resources really are not the answer to poverty because many African and Latin American nations have immense resources, but they remain poor. But nations such as Japan, Taiwan, and Singapore all lack significant resources, but they've become wealthy by creating productive economies, and they've produced their own prosperity. A fourth solution, wrong solution, that people have suggested after more aid, debt forgiveness, natural resources, the fourth wrong solution is blaming poverty on outside factors. But this does not increase a nation's GDP. Blaming poverty on colonialism, on the world economic system, on world market prices for coffee or other goods, blaming it on multinational corporations or rich nations. The analysis of these factors in several cases is fairly complex, and we have more detailed analysis in the book. But the question facing leaders in poor countries is not who can I blame, because that's not going to make you become more productive. The question is, what can we do now looking forward? What will continually increase our GDP? What will help us produce more goods and services of value? That's the focus. Fifth wrong solution, printing money. No comment. Printing money does not increase GDP because money is not itself a product of value. People cannot eat money or wear money or ride it or drive on it or plant or drive in it or plant it. They cannot put money over their heads to protect them from the sun and the rain. They can use money to buy other things, of course, but this is because money is a medium of exchange. It's not in itself a product of value. And the example we give in the book is, if you take Honduras again, if it has $36 billion gross domestic product per year, and then it prints another $10 billion in currency, its gross domestic product is still $36 billion. Adding more cash to the system doesn't increase your gross domestic product. Now, of course, many of you know it's going to add to inflation and there are the other consequences, but it doesn't produce more products of value. The main point, the goal is produce more goods and services. That is what increases GDP, and it increases per capita income, and it brings you out of poverty. Now, you might say, sounds good, but can nations actually do this? Have any nations ever come out of poverty by producing more? Yes. Every wealthy nation in the world today has done this. Because, you see, if we go back 250 or 300 years, there were no wealthy nations. There were a few wealthy kings and royal families, and everybody else lived very poor life. And then in the late 1700s, beginning with the Industrial Revolution, some nations began to produce more, much more. Their factories produced more goods and their farms produced more food. Their per capita income doubled and then quadrupled and then kept on increasing. Britain was the leader in all this in the Industrial Revolution, producing textiles, especially cotton, far faster and far cheaper and better than anyone in the world. Many other manufactured products in England followed, and soon other nations in Europe and North America began to produce their own prosperity. But that process did not end in the 18th and 19th centuries, because even in the 20th century, the pattern has continued. In the early 1900s, Japan was a poor agricultural economy, but it grew to the second largest economy in the late 20th century by manufacturing cars, computers, TVs, cameras, steel, and ships. It produced its own prosperity. South Korea, in the 1950s, was one of the poorest nations in the world, poorer than many countries in Africa. But South Korea is the 12th richest nation in the world today by per capita income because it's manufacturing products like TVs, cars, computers, and microwaves. Chile. Chile began to move out of poverty in the 1970s by growing abundant fruits and vegetables for export. And the most recent apple I ate had a little label on it that said Chile. China is growing by producing millions of small manufactured goods. Every nation that has escaped poverty has done so by producing its own prosperity. Now, stepping aside from that historical survey for a minute and speaking as a Christian theologian, I think that producing prosperity, creating wealth, is an activity unique to the human race. I think it's a divinely given activity. And it flows out of obedience to God's command to Adam and Eve in Genesis 1 to fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. That command to subdue, the Hebrew word, means to make it useful, make it serviceable, produce products that are helpful and valuable for human beings, for which God's intention was that we would eat and wear and drive and use with thanksgiving to Him as the infinitely wise Creator who planted such incredible resources in the earth and gave us the God-given wisdom to develop those resources in imitation of God's own creative ability. The ability to create wealth where it didn't exist before does not exist in the animal kingdom. It is an ability unique to the human race. Last week, Margaret and I went to Lens Crafters. The guy in the lab there took what looked like a little round ashtray of plastic about that big. You'd say maybe it's worth 5 cents. Put it in the machine, ground it, and out came some lenses for my glasses that cost me about $100 per lens. 5 cents worth of plastic becomes $100 in a lens. How does that happen? He's added wealth to the nation that wasn't there before. In just an hour, he added $100, $200 worth of wealth. That activity goes on throughout the earth, throughout history, making shirts from fabric, making bread from wheat, adding value to the products that were there before. I think it's a wonderful God-given activity, and I think it's what God wants us to do. Now, I have 78 facts. But I want to talk about those three broad areas and just give you some examples of what those 78 factors are. The first broad area is the economy, the second broad area is the government, and the third broad area is the cultural beliefs and values. So let's start first with the economic system, the only economic system that has ever brought any nation from poverty to prosperity is the free market. The free market system is superior to all economic systems in the history of the world, and my colleague Barry Asmus and I have a chapter in which we survey failed economic systems, hunting and gathering in the primitive history of mankind, subsistence farming. They did not produce prosperity. Slavery in the ancient world did not produce prosperity. Tribal ownership of land did not and will not and does not produce prosperity. Feudalism, mercantilism, socialism and communism, the welfare state and equality, those economic systems are basically the major systems that have been tried throughout the history of the world, and we go through a few pages of each one saying they failed, they failed, they failed. They will not produce prosperity. The reason we put that chapter in is that people will object when we make these presentations and say, you're arguing for the free market system. Well, I don't like communism. I don't like socialism, but I don't like the free market system either. Let's see if we can dream up another system. And our answer is, all the systems that have been tried in the history of the world haven't worked. So then we turn to a better system, the free market system. Except for a few oil-rich Middle Eastern nations whose wealth will not endure forever, all nations with a high per capita income today have become wealthy through various forms of a free market system. We define the free market in this way. It's one in which economic production and consumption are determined by the free choices of individuals rather than by governments. And it's grounded in the private ownership of the means of production. The essence of it is the free choices of individuals determine what is bought and sold and what is produced in an economy, not the government. By free market system, we clarify, we do not mean anarchy. We do not mean there should be no law. In order for people to be able to make voluntary choices and informed choices, they have to be protected from theft and crime and breaking of contracts. There needs to be a rule of law to have the idea of a free market preserved, because the idea of free voluntary exchanges is violated when people steal from or cheat each other or deceive others. So there will be laws against theft and fraud and violation of contracts and the sale of defective and dangerous products. A country can have such laws and remain a free market system because the decisions about what to produce and consume are left to individual people, not made by government. A free market system also depends on a stable currency and low tax rates for the market to function well. Again, I'm going to give you an aside, because we do this frequently in the book, and say that it seems to me that there is significant biblical support for a free market system. There is, that is, significant biblical support for human freedom in economic systems and for deciding what is produced and what is bought and sold in a nation. That comes from various strands of thought in the Bible. First of all, the teaching about private property in the Bible. I can't go into detail now, but it's very significant. It begins in the Ten Commandments. You shall not steal. If I shall not steal your laptop computer, that assumes that it belongs to you and not to me. And there were many provisions in the Old Testament laws that protected people's property. So if you started a fire and it burned your neighbor's grain, you had to make restitution. If you stole your neighbor's ox or donkey, you had to make restitution and then some. Property was protected. And of course, the dramatic narrative example that anchors that is the story of the most wicked king and queen couple in the Bible, Ahab and Jezebel. Ahab saw a vineyard that he wanted belonging to Naboth. Was next to Naboth's land, next to Ahab's land, and he wanted it, and he plotted and had Naboth killed to take his property from him. But of course, God brought judgment on them as a result in 1 Kings 21. Private property is an important concept in Scripture. Second, the biblical concept of personal stewardship to God, before for the property that we own. Stewardship of your property can only be exercised when individuals are free to choose how to use their property. Third, the biblical teaching for a limited role for government. Government is to punish wrongdoers and reward those who do good and maintain order in a society. But there is no biblical teaching that government has the right to manage all the economic decisions of a nation or decide what is produced or what is bought and sold. And then the fourth reason is the absence of any clear biblical support for the idea that government should control the economy of a nation, or that government should not allow economic freedom. Government doesn't need any special warrant to leave people alone and leave the economy alone. Yesterday afternoon, I was on Hugh Hewitt's show, thanks to Salem Network, talking about chapter 6 in our book, The Moral Advantages of Free Markets. When we begin to talk about free markets, people object, oh, isn't the free market system immoral? It depends on greed. Our response is, the free market system depends on self-interest, not greed. Self-interest is a good and healthy thing. Adam Smith said, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest." Self-interest is a morally good thing. It's why we eat breakfast in the morning instead of starving. It's why we shop for goods at a lower price rather than a higher price. And we work in order to earn a living and support ourselves. The worker's appetite works for him, says the book of Proverbs. His mouth urges him on. Self-interest is built into human existence as a very good thing. Greed is excessive self-interest. The free market moderates and directs greed to purposeful ends so that people who seek to gain a profit seek also thereby, if they're wise, to meet the needs and wants of others. But the important point is the free market system does not depend on greed. It depends on human self-interest, which is an unavoidable fact of life and a morally good thing, not anything evil. But the free market system has other moral advantages. First, it promotes freedom of choice for moral actions. If the government takes all your money and spends it for you, you've lost your ability to make morally significant decisions in your spending. Socialism erodes people's moral backbone. But if you are free to choose how to spend your money and your time, you have then a sense of moral stewardship and moral accountability. You can make wiser, foolish choices. You can be honest and truthful and fair in your business dealings. You can be generous. The free market depends on voluntary exchanges, which have moral significance. And again, the Bible places a high value on human freedom and voluntary choices from the time that Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden and had to choose whether to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil or not. Choose you this day whom you will serve, says Joshua, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. A free market system also promotes freedom for abstract or spiritual pursuits. If people want to spend their lifetime trying to compose music or paint paintings, they're free to do that, whereas a socialist economy would force them into government-approved activities. And again, speaking as a Christian professor of Bible and theology, I would say a free market system gives me freedom to work at something a socialist economy would maybe not deem useful, and that is thinking about the Bible all day long. In fact, as in over 30 years of teaching, I do not think any significant great theologians or biblical scholars in all of history have come out of totalitarian societies. They don't have time for it. Free market promotes freedom for abstract or spiritual pursuits. Someone could become a pastor, a priest, or a rabbi if he chooses. Free market system also promotes personal integrity and truth-telling. These are moral values that can be hindered or helped by the economic system. I won't return to a store where a grocer lied about the freshness of the bread or the milk. Why? Because he lied to me, and there's always another grocer where I can shop. I won't return to an auto mechanic who lied about the repairs that he supposedly performed on my car. The free market means the only thing that brings the customer back is his free choice, and that encourages truth-telling and integrity in business. The free market also promotes moral accountability for your work. Margaret and I had some windows repaired in our home recently. And after the repair people left, I noticed that the caulking wasn't right at the base of one window. I called the company. What did they do? They sent the same guy back out, make it right. He's accountable for his actions because the free market depends on the free choice of individuals, and they want to make the customer happy. So moral accountability is promoted. The free market also curbs materialism and promotes personal charity. Charitable giving is much higher in free market economies than in state-controlled economies because people have more money to choose what to do with. Free market also promotes meeting the needs of others and meeting the wants of others. That's one aspect of what Jesus told us to do. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Meeting the needs and wants of others are promoted in a free market economy because you want to give consumers a good product. Is the new iPhone better than the Android system? Well, manufacturers are continually trying to make a product that people like better. Is Verizon service better or AT&T service? They're working at making better. They're working. Do we see what's happening? They're working to meet people's needs and meet people's wants. They're working to do good for other people. And I think anyone can work in those companies with an honest heart saying, what I am doing for this company is trying to love my neighbor as myself, to act in a way that brings benefit to other people. The free market economy promotes that as opposed to a socialist or government-controlled economy. The free market system truly helps the poor. It succeeds far better than any other system in enabling growth in the whole nation and enabling the most people to escape poverty. The free market system, interestingly, also promotes what Tufts professor Lawrence Harrison calls promoting the lesser virtues: punctuality, courtesy, tidiness, and a job well done. Think about the plumber who comes to repair your kitchen faucet. Does the free market system encourage punctuality? Yes, he tries to show up on time, so you think he's reliable. How about courtesy? Yes, because you won't invite a rude plumber back. What about tidiness? Oh, yes, because if he leaves your kitchen a mess, you don't want him to come back. And what about a job well done? Yes, and when I called the window repair company and said the job wasn't well done, you can believe that that guy is going to do a better job next time. It promotes these lesser virtues: punctuality, courtesy, tidiness, and a job well done. Well, those are some of the moral benefits of a free market system, the moral advantages. I do not think we should be intimidated by a moment by those who say a free market system is not morally sound. It is morally anchored and substantial, and it is what I think God intends us to do on the earth. Well, that's area number one. It's a few of those factors, the free market system and some of its components. Area two is what kind of government should be produced. The second area is 38 factors about government that lead to a government that is characteristic of serving people rather than the rulers themselves. That's consistent with Romans 13:4, where God says that the civil authority is God's servant for your good. And if rulers who have authority in poor countries will believe deep in their hearts, and if the culture believes that their purpose is to serve for the good of the nation, then that's the heart of the change from corruption. I cannot go into those 38 factors at this moment, but you can look at them in the book. And the last area is 35 cultural values and beliefs that will promote economic growth. Believing there is a God, believing he approves of character traits that promote productivity. Skip over that. Valuing truthfulness, because trust is important in productivity. Believing the earth is here for the use and benefit of human beings. Believing that mutual gains come from voluntary exchange, and therefore a good business deal benefits both buyer and seller. That was the cultural values. That was 35 of those. Stu, I'm hurrying to the end. I need to say a couple of things in conclusion. In the beginning of the book and at the end of the book, Dr. Barry Asmus and I want to warn against materialism. If we are talking about overcoming poverty, we're necessarily talking about economic things that can be measured in dollars and cents. But the Bible doesn't make economic things most important. It makes relationship with God and relationship with family and friends most important. So the last two cultural values that we end with, 34, the society counts family, friends, and joy in life as more important than material wealth. And we do say that, frankly, it may be the case in many poor countries that they do a better job of this than wealthy countries do. And then the last one is 35, the society counts spiritual well-being and a relationship with God as more important than material wealth. We do not believe that material prosperity is the most important issue in the world. For Jesus taught that love for God and love for neighbor are the two greatest commandments, Matthew 22:37-39. But if we're talking about how to solve world poverty, the solution can only come through increased economic productivity within poor nations themselves. Who can change those cultural beliefs that will change the government and change the economy? Pastors are important. They have vast influence. Teachers, educators, TVs, movies, literature. In any case, there is only one effective solution to world poverty. Poor nations must produce their own prosperity. Many are already doing this. All poor nations are able to do this. We are hoping that in this book, The Poverty of Nations, leaders will begin to consider these 78 factors. To the extent that a nation begins to implement them, it will begin to liberate its own people and enable them to become more productive as God intended them to be. Today, millions of poor people around the world are trapped in lifelong poverty, not because people in other countries are rich, but because their poor nations are living under oppression. They're oppressed by economic systems that cannot bring prosperity except for a tiny despotic elite. They're oppressed by laws and governments that cannot bring prosperity except for a tiny group of privileged rulers. And they are oppressed by dominant cultural beliefs and values that perpetuate poverty and cannot produce prosperity. It is time to set them free. Thank you.